So, hey, I'm very grateful for the short introduction. I don't understand introductions. Google is your friend. So thank you for actually obeying my wishes there. Nearly 20 years ago now, an article was published that proved, unfortunately, prescient about problems, but was quite wrong about solutions, in my opinion. The article was Progressivism and Philanthropy. It was published in The Good Society in 2006, by Lenore and Steve Ely. I will refer to this as the double Ely. Watson and Crick discovered the double helix. I have rediscovered the double Ely of social entrepreneurship. Now, in reading it, I'm reminded of the wisdom of Ecclesiastes. In chapter 1, we're told, "The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done. There is no new thing under the sun." As the double Ely argue, at the end of the 19th century, 1880, 1890, America faced then unfamiliar circumstances, but they'll sound familiar to you. Traditional social institutions seemed to be becoming obsolete at a rapid pace. They threatened the hope for social stability. Immigration had swelled the rank and diversity of the urban poor. Headlong economic changes radically changed the way in which people worked and lived. Workers felt a growing sense of precariousness, and they felt overwhelmed. The increasing complexity of social and economic affairs contributed to a widespread belief that a new social and political order must be created. And there was a notion that social entrepreneurship was not just possible, but necessary. And so forth stood the progressives into the role of that social entrepreneurship. Now, the double Ely was actually optimistic in 2006, because their reading of this was that we were about to see the end of progressivism, because of decentralization that was working through expanded social media and the unshackling of individual, private, voluntary social entrepreneurship. It has not come to pass. I'm going to argue that there is a new rebirth of the progressive impulse in a way that makes some kind of superficial sense. It is the effective altruism movement, born of rationalism, with a capital R. It's an oddly clumsy kind of rationalism, though, ignoring all that we know about commercial systems as a source of coordination for massive economic resources at scale. And scale is a recurrent theme, and rightly so. Remember that Adam Smith said in his brilliant chapter title for chapter 3 of book 1 of The Wealth of Nations that the division of labor is limited by the extent of the market. So the elaboration of division of labor is expanded by scale. And that's the source of wealth and growth. Now, Smith also said, and this is important, that that urge for scale was embedded in a social system of propriety and acceptance of tradition and culture. I'm afraid that many people on my side, and particularly from the public choice tradition, have tended to emphasize the beauty of markets without emphasizing the importance of the commercial society in which it is embedded. So I am at least partly to blame, mea culpa. So entrepreneurship is constantly looking for elaborations of division of labor, or for seeing around corners, as Israel Kirzner has argued. There's constant attempts to conjure some analogous role for entrepreneurship in politics and civil life. The problem is there's no feedback mechanism like profit and loss. Is the innovation creating value? Now, politics works on votes, but there's no reason to expect the proposal that gets the most votes is going to create value. And it ignores problems of involuntary taking or property rights. So it's difficult to judge social entrepreneurship on any sort of the same kind of standing that we get from profits in commercial markets. The other role for entrepreneurship is even more murky. It's Weber's charismatic leader, a blind and ineffable faith in the wisdom and destiny of the leader no matter what goes wrong. Now, you think I'm talking about Donald Trump. I'm not. I'm talking about Sam Bankman-Fried. Rationalism elides over into intuitionism and charisma if we rely on that kind of collective social entrepreneurship. So let's turn back to the discussion of the Double Ely paper for some insights. Progressivism has three main tenets. It sees itself as scientific, evidence-driven policy, often connected to evolutionary psychology, or at its worst, full-blown, unapologetic eugenics. The moral basis for this view is utilitarianism. At its worst, this can be blown into simple diminishing margin utility of income taxes, advocating then for equality, because if you take money from a wealthy person, it costs them less than giving it to a poor person. And so you keep doing that until it's gone. Problem is that this often is directed simply against rich people. I wrote a piece recently about the 10 years after song, Save the World, which some people in this room may be old enough to remember. Tax the rich, feed the poor, till there are no rich no more. What a strange lyric. Not until there's no poor no more, until there's no rich no more. So that's the impulse. This is paired with a public health priesthood with absolute powers because of a cult of professionalism and the excessive faith in credentialism. A deep faith, second, in centralization and economies of scale. Now, scale is always the thing that progressives are going to want to try to emphasize. And that sounds like an analogy to division of labor is limited by the extent of the market. Scale is not. Scale is the size of the plan, not the size of the effect. And that's a fundamentally different thing. Third, an abiding faith in the weakness and incapacity of individuals. The fragility or anachronism of emergent institutions and private associations, and the strength of elite-driven top-down solutions. Now, for some reason, this weakness of individuals for progressives does not extend to elites. They're smart people who've been professionalized, have better information, and much better motives. The reliance on credentials, expertise, and the guild of elitism are indispensable parts of progressivism. Now, far from being opposed by the private sector, this transformation was actively encouraged and sometimes financed between 1890 and 1920 by the then fledgling philanthropic foundations of Carnegie, Rockefeller, Sage, and others, who subscribed to some version of this new corporate liberalism. The hierarchical corporate organization of business entities created a workforce with middle-class means and proletarian status. By mid-century, in the wake of the New Deal, America's institutions and practices of voluntary mutual aid were widely displaced by specialized professionals. Those in need of assistance became clients or cases as charity became medicalized. Now, the reason to go through that history is that history is repeating itself. It's surprising to me how many corporations are trying to participate in partnerships with the state to accomplish effective altruism as a way of achieving scale. It's exactly the same impulse, and like causes are producing like effects. This may sound familiar. This is John Dewey in 1935. Organized social planning put into effect for the creation of an order in which industry and finance are socially directed in behalf of institutions that provide the material basis for the cultural liberation and growth of individuals is now the sole method of social action by which liberalism can realize its professed aims. That might as well be a press statement by Bill Gates. It is exactly the same impulse. So at the turn of another century, new circumstances are rendering the original progressive prescriptions largely obsolete. It is true that American society is outgrowing the institutions that progressives designed for it. and the double Ely successfully foresaw that. Government administration has been shown to suffer from and to reinforce significant knowledge problems. So, in short, the centralization thrust of the 20th century seemed to be giving way to a decentralizing tendency in the 21st century. Except that which was done is that which will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Where in the 1920s there was John Dewey, today there is Will McCaskill and Peter Singer. McCaskill, the new John Dewey, wants to maximize expected value. So the goal of effective altruism is on every front when it comes to helping people, we need to maximize expected value. As he put it, it's not always true that exactly 80% of the value comes from the top 20% of activities. Sometimes things are even more extreme than that. But the general rule that most of the value generated comes from the very best activities is very common. And so the implication is obvious. Eliminate all of those activities that are not the highest valued activities. And we know what those highest valued activities are because all is known by us. We have AI, we have ways of gathering data. The hubris then of this new impulse towards a kind of progressivism that's now wearing effective altruism clothes is surprising. Where there was unlimited funding power of Ford, Rockefeller, and Carnegie, today there was Sam Bankman-Fried, and there still is the Gates Foundation. Now, we have been, as I said, I partly want to take blame for this. We have been caught in a state market dualism that limits our understanding of the broad scope of voluntary organizations and institutions. So the voluntary coercive distinction is actually a continuum, a dimension along which there is small amounts of variation, not two clean sets of discrete categories. Second, the essence of private philanthropy is its voluntary and decentralized features. It's private because it's voluntary and decentralized, and therefore local entrepreneurs can have an effect. But it's philanthropy because it's focused on accomplishing shared or collective goals as opposed to mere commercial exchange. So a standard kind of public choice view is that there's really just two sectors. There's markets and the state. Markets are voluntary, the state is coercive. Almost none of that is true. What the state is a monopoly. There are coercive elements in markets. There are all kinds of market power. John Hesnes at Georgetown has argued this extensively and I think persuasively. What is important is the existence of an alternative, a workaround in the case of market power that doesn't exist in the case of coercive government power. That's the mistake of the public-private partnership, is that it actually excludes other kinds of entrepreneurship. So this neo-progressive impulse of effective altruism to maximize expected value means that there's a single best solution. I'm not making this up. There is a single best solution. Once it is found, we will do that thing until we reach the inflection point where at the margin, it becomes better to do the next best thing. Now, there is kind of a comedy routine along these grounds, and I'm sure that some of you will find it offensive. That's good. It's 11 o'clock. It's time some of you were offended. I can think of no other reason why I was invited to speak. So that's clearly the justification. So remember, the premise is that the most effective thing that a philanthropic act could have is whatever is the greatest impact. And then we'll focus all our money on that. And the premise in the comedian's little act was that this is malaria nets, or I should say anti-malaria nets. It's not a smallpox blanket thing. So mosquito nets, we'll call it mosquito nets. And since mosquito nets that prevent people from getting malaria is the single best philanthropic activity we can hope for, all philanthropic activity should be devoted to that. And so then what happens to the other philanthropies, like Autism Speaks? No, autism shouldn't speak. It should make malaria nets. They might be good at that. They can concentrate. What about the Make-A-Wish Foundation? Well, no, don't make a wish, make a net. And when the, because some of these kids, they've got 2 or 3 good weeks left. They could be making malaria nets. The little kid comes up and says, am I going to get my wish? Well, that depends. Is your wish to make nets? So we will take all the other charities, no matter what they are, we'll put them into a giant net, we'll just lower them into the lava. And the only thing we'll do is make anti-malaria nets. And you say, well, that sounds wasteful. Well, yeah, I wasted a net putting them into the lava. The point that I have become increasingly convinced of over time is there's a need for our side to emphasize and celebrate entrepreneurship, but not of the market only. Churches, private voluntary organizations that once were the animating force of local American philanthropy. Effective altruism is the opposite of this. It is we will find a single activity which, when operated at scale, will have the largest impact. We don't know enough about what those things are, and we're not able to organize those things as well as local entrepreneurs. So much of the supposed benefit is going to be eaten up and wasted in, and I haven't even used this phrase yet, but you know I want to, transaction costs. The answer to every question in economics, when thought about correctly, is transaction costs. So the impulse for scale is actually deadly. Kindness doesn't operate well at scale. Information is scattered, available in quality only to F.A. Hayek's man on the spot. Serving needs simply cannot be done at scale. Each of us is an entrepreneur every day. The scale effects can be achieved by aggregating millions of small local actions targeted at the best local actions, rather than focusing million together on a single great cause. Now, I have an example, and it's self-aggrandizing because of course it is. I had in one of my Duke classes the daughter of a famous startup founder. You would certainly know who this person is. His daughter was in my Duke class. She was taking my freshman class, and she mentioned to Dad that the readings were really interesting and had changed the way she thought about the world. He arranged a Zoom meeting with me, and I was pretty excited. This is a rich guy, and he likes my class. I can be an entrepreneur. He wanted to know how he could have an effect to do more of this kind of thing. And I mentioned that Duke's PPE program needed support and that $10,000 per year could have a really big impact, thinking that that would be a selling point. He laughed and said he only wanted to work with things that had at least 2 more zeros because it was important to focus on scale. Now, I said, okay, $1 million would be okay, but that's not what he had in mind. He only had the one daughter, so I asked him if he was a sperm donor. If you want to operate at scale, you have to find some other margin to work on. Now, I can wait. So the reading, it was interesting what the reading was. This family was devout atheists, and he pretty quickly shared that when we were talking. But the reading was Thomas Aquinas. So we were talking about the morality of markets and the difficulty of understanding the place of commercial society in a place where culture really matters. She'd never read Thomas Aquinas before. She's a smart person. She read it, and she said, dang, this is really interesting. So one student reading one great book and then discussing it with one instructor and a small class of other students is the kind of entrepreneurship that we need to encourage, that making that possible for many more students. Now, this young woman is at Duke. She comes from a very wealthy family. She went to a terrific high school. She's going to be okay. The entrepreneurial question is, how do we make this kind of life-changing experience available at scale by producing it everywhere at the local level, not sacrifice autism speaks to making malaria nets? So It seems to me that our entrepreneurship must refocus on making that kind of experience available to more people, not trying to concentrate that experience in the equivalent of a pill so that it can be administered at scale. Thanks for listening.